Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. A vote for renewable homegrown energy or for a monster of a subsidy. That sums up the arguments heard all summer over a bill called SB 365 to support New Hampshire's biomass industry. It passed both the House and Senate earlier this year, but Governor Sununu vetoed it, saying it would mean higher prices for all ratepayers. The veto sparked a huge backlash, including from many Republicans who generally support the governor and agree with him. So now, as lawmakers gather on Thursday to consider overriding this veto, paired with another alternative energy bill, no one knows what will happen. But today in The Exchange, we explore the background of this veto uproar. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest for the hour is NHPR's Annie Ropeek, our energy and environment reporter, and we'll hear from several key voices in this debate throughout the hour, both from those who support the biomass industry and those who don't. And Annie, you're always helping us out. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, so Annie, the governor said he vetoed the bill because it includes what he calls monster subsidies for the biomass industry. What kind of subsidies are we talking about, Annie? Because from what I understand, it's not a direct cash government subsidy. It's a little different.
Yeah, that's right. So what this bill would have done is tell utilities like Eversource to buy more biomass energy and also energy from waste energy plants that burn municipal trash for energy, just one of those. So it's six biomass plants and one waste energy plant. It would have had utilities like Eversource buy more power from those plants at a discounted rate, so 80% of the wholesale price. So it's a little cheaper for Eversource, but it's a required part of their portfolio now, and this helps prop those plants up because they're struggling financially a bit. And so it's a subsidy in the sense that it's sort of a mandated shot of revenue for those plants. But really, the cost of that that subsidy of those plants gets passed on to ratepayers for a short-term amount of time.
So the governor says ratepayers will end up paying the cost, as you said, Annie. And let's hear him talking about this in a recent interview.
And you know who has to pay for that? The elderly, low-income families, everyone that turns on a light switch. We have 2.7% unemployment in this state. Huge opportunity right now when it comes to jobs, North Country and otherwise. I think that number in COAS is 3.0, something like that. So I've sat with families, I sat with owners of those plants. I probably know more about this issue than almost anybody in the state. It's not an easy decision by any means, but it's the absolute right decision.
So the absolute right decision, that's Governor Sununu talking there. So how did this get started, Annie? The whole idea of giving biomass plants, I'm calling it a subsidy, but again, you explained it's a little bit different. But go ahead.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I might call it a bit of a bailout or a sort of a short-term bailout plan, a shot in the arm, if you would. And so this is not a new idea. And Sununu himself actually signed another bill this very year that subsidized just one particular biomass plant, which is sort of the biggest and most successful one. That's Burgess in Berlin, and that's an Eversource plant. And so he did sign a bill that gave them a little bit of money, and that's because they are staying afloat, relatively speaking. And so that sort of, I think, made more sense to Sununu because it was more of a direct economic benefit, whereas this one, I think he thought the costs outweighed the benefits. But, you know, these biomass plants have been getting some help from the government for a long time, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. One of those reasons is that they provide markets for the timber industry that it lost when a lot of paper mills closed. They also provide local jobs in rural parts of the state, not just in the North Country. And they also provide what some people would call renewable energy energy, or at least not fossil fuels, and add some more diversity to the grid. And so there are benefits from these plants, and they've needed some help getting off the ground. Supporters of this bill say that this bill is just another bridge for them to really sort of get stable and be sort of more viable long term. But clearly, Sununu disagrees.
And you said a moment ago, Annie, that some of these plants have been struggling. Most of them have been struggling. How come? What are they struggling against?
Well, it's a tough business to be in. You know, they're not making a ton of power. Altogether, it's about 100 megawatts of energy. And, you know, just for example, Northern Pass alone, that was the transmission line that was going to bring hydropower down from Canada. That one project was 1,200 megawatts of energy. So they are pretty small scale. They have, you know, high overhead costs. It's a serious sort of an industrial process that they're doing here. And also the timber that they're buying is cheap, and they have to buy a lot of it to do what they do. It, you know, makes up a lot of the trees in this state, again, because we used to grow them to feed paper mills, and that's why we now need markets for them. But, you know, it's not a lot of money that's changing hands here, and so the business model is a little bit tenuous there. And they also, you know, are trying to compete with bigger scale, sort of more ingrained forms of energy, with other renewables that are higher dollar and sort of shinier and more popular in the public eye, and with, you know, things like natural gas and even these coal and oil plants that have been around for so long that they're really on sort of a different level financially than these biomass plants can be. They've gotten subsidies of their own in the past, and that's sort of how the energy market works. So it's tough to break in.
So it's yet another story in a way, Annie, and we've talked about this before, how the recent relative abundance of natural gas has kind of upended a lot of others in the energy sector.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's really hard for almost anyone to compete with natural gas at this point. If there's a hole in the grid, natural gas is more than likely going to fill it because it is so cheap. And that's one argument that supporters of this bill have made, is that if these plants, you know, go under, it's not going to be other renewables necessarily that are replacing them. It's going to be natural gas more than likely. And that's even less popular than biomass, for example, or, you know, than many of these sort of coal and oil plants, some of which burn biomass. Plants like Bow, like the Meramec Station in Bow, and Schiller in Portsmouth, these former Eversource plants that are sort of the throw anything you want into them and they'll burn it for fuel, they use biomass as well.
Well, we got an email from William in Cornish who says the wood chip trash plant owners want an annual $20 million bailout. The money would be taken from Eversource and Unitil customers like a tax or as a gift from electricity customers, most of whom are everyday people. The power plant owners should open their books if they want the public's money. This veto has stopped this controversy in its tracks. William, thank you for the email. So, Annie, that's the free market argument that the governor and others have made. The Josiah Bartlett Center called this bill corporate welfare dressed up in flannel.
It's interesting because, you know, the idea that the energy space is a free market is sort of a falsehood. I mean, so many different other forms of energy are already receiving subsidies or have received subsidies in the past, whether it's for siting infrastructure or for import of needed fuel. And also the power companies are getting a guaranteed rate of return, again, because they're providing a necessary service. And so, you know, it can't be driven by traditional supply and demand economics, because then our lights potentially wouldn't turn on one day just because the prices got too high or because the temperatures were too mild and there wasn't a good enough reason for the power companies to be supplying energy. So biomass is just another piece of that puzzle. You know, the idea of subsidizing a new form of energy is not new. We've done that with wind and solar most recently. And it's true that the costs would be passed on to ratepayers in the short term. One of the arguments against that is that if these plants were to pull out of the grid, there would be some costs associated with that that would last longer. And so it is, you know, arguably sort of between a rock and a hard place when you're trying to sustain a chunk of energy that's already on the grid. It's there. It's made commitments. We're paying for it one way or the other.
Well, again, that's NHPR's Annie Ropeek, our environment and energy reporter. And today in The Exchange, we are looking at this uproar over the governor's veto of two bills, one on biomass subsidies, or a shot in the arm, as Annie has described it. And a little bit later, we'll look at another bill. This has been paired with the biomass bill. It would put a cap on energy contributions to the grid, something called net metering. This veto has caused, again, a big campaign in the state. You've probably seen the signs around overturn the veto. We are asking your thoughts on this today. Will these vetoes cripple the biomass and solar and alternative energy industries, or will ratepayers be footing the bill to keep these alternative energies viable? You can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And again, William and Cornish, thank you for that email. Annie, let's bring a couple more voices into our conversation now. With us is Mark Brown, Executive Director of the New England Ratepayers Association. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
And also with us, Jason Stock, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association. And Jason, welcome back. Good to have you too.
Oh, great. Good morning.
Well, Jason, to you first, why do biomass plants need this boost? Why can't they do this on their own?
Well, the biomass plants, and, I've explained it, this issue for the biomass plants is not unique to them. Right now, the wholesale electricity prices are so low that biomass and a number of other types of generators are unable to maintain economic viability 12 months out of the year. And so what you have is a situation where they've said, look, if you want us as part of the energy mix, particularly when other forms of energy, such as natural gas, are getting diverted to other uses, we need some assurances in terms of a contract that we can continue to run so that when you do need us, we'll be there. And so, like I said, this is not unique to the biomass plants. There are nuclear power plants and others, even some fossil fuel plants, that are kind of in the same boat, and they've gone to either their legislature in other states or even the ISO New England saying, look, we need contracts to run. So
biomass isn't the only one getting government help. It's just that this is more visible. Is that what you're saying, Jason?
Well, it's more visible. It's more local. It's New Hampshire, and this is a New Hampshire, the New Hampshire power plants, and it's the New Hampshire that's why it's more visible here.
Well, I want to play a clip for you from Republican State Representative Michael Vose of Epping. He was speaking on WMUR recently, so credit to them. And, he says he's heard the concerns of the forest products industry, but he says the state's important manufacturing sector is also struggling with high energy prices. So let's hear a little bit from State Representative Michael Vose.
It's an argument that we in the Science, Technology, and Energy Committee hear over and over and over from big New Hampshire corporate entities like BAE and Sig Sauer and Lindt Chocolates and Whelan Engineering and Velcro and on and on and on. The continuing escalation in the cost of electricity is a huge issue for our state, and many, many jobs are at stake.
So, Jason Stock, I want to ask you what you think about that. Governor Sununu, Representative Vose, both seem to say, look, we feel your pain, but this is about, 1.3 million people, not just a select few in the industry.
Yeah, and again, it's, as Amy was saying, that, this is a bigger picture when you look at energy security and energy infrastructure. And when you look at the biomass power plants, and their contribution to the state, both in terms of energy, but also jobs and economic activity, we believe the 365 justifies, there's justification for it economically. Yes, there's over 900 jobs attributable right to those power plants, and $250 million a year in economic activity associated with them. And as she had mentioned earlier, loss of that 100 megawatts of power, there are consequences to that in terms of having to replace power down the road in the next capacity auction. And that has been vetted and proven through the hearing process. And so there is a bigger, and for us, we look at this and there's a bigger picture here, or a bigger question about what do we want New Hampshire's long-term energy strategy to be looking like? And let's not just look at the next year or two. Let's look at New Hampshire as a state and try to be more self-sufficient and position ourselves so that we can control our own energy future and not have to be reliant on import of power from other states or other countries.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. And Mark Brown, I want to bring you in. What about the idea that, you know, ISO New England itself, the system operator, has said we're way too reliant on natural gas. Nuclear plants are closing around the region. You know, wind and solar are getting going, but there's sometimes it's hard to cite these projects. Here we've got these biomass plants already up and running. So why not support these plants as a way to ensure stability and reliability in the grid?
Because they're never going to be economic, Laura. They never have been. You know, they were built based on, you know, a federal policy that provided them with above market costs. You know, SB 365 would increase electricity rates by $20 million. What Jason was referencing with regards to the, you know, replacing them in the capacity market, there's this $17 million number being bandied about that just, it's unsubstantiated. Nobody knows where it came from. You know, the claim was made in a hearing, but to say that it was vetted, I think, is a bit of a stretch. I mean, let me just give you an idea, okay? Most recent capacity auction cleared at $4.60.
Okay, hang on, Mark, because I don't think most listeners know what a capacity auction is, so you're going to have to tell us what that is and fit into this. Yeah, go ahead.
Every year, ISO holds a capacity auction for basically generation in the region, and there's what's called, and I don't want to get too wonky here,
sure,
but you know, we have a certain amount of megawatt hours that ISO deems that we need in order to provide, you know, reliable electricity service to the region, and that takes into account, you know, some plants were to go online, there'd be backup power and all of that. So every year there's a capacity auction, and the capacity auctions run 3 years out, and they, you know, they change from year to year what prices clear that capacity auction. Again, I don't want to get too, you know, we could spend, you know, all week talking about this.
Yeah.
But just to give you an idea, so the most recent auction cleared at what's called $4.63 a capacity a kilowatt month, okay? So for that recent auction, New Hampshire's ratepayers would be paying those plants that Jason referenced about $500,000, okay, to run, to receive capacity payments.
I guess what I'm asking is, I'm sorry to interrupt. I guess what I'm asking is, you seem to be saying, look, it's not worth it. It's going to raise rates for the average New Hampshire person, and sorry, but it's just not worth it.
Yeah, it's going to raise rates by $20 million, and it's going to raise rates to Eversource and Unitil's customers. It's a tax. This is nothing more than a tax. If it is a tax, if this is a jobs bill, then this should be done through the general fund, not through the opacity of electricity rates.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so, and to that point about the jobs aspect of it, and it's interesting that you make that point, Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, as you know, Mark, big supporter of this bill. He also spoke on WMUR. He says if the veto remains, the impact's going to be devastating, not just to the industry, but many other related industries and communities. I want to just play a little bit of that for you and then bring both of you back in.
Suppliers of heavy equipment have lost at least $10 million in sales as a result of the veto. Logging operations have been curtailed. The biomass plants are no longer buying fuel because they're no longer producing. These impacts are real. People are losing their jobs. Property taxes in different communities is going to be undermined because these plants are going to disappear. Fuel tax, business tax for the state, timber tax for municipalities. There is a range of impacts. Unfortunately, I don't think the governor saw it, how devastating the consequences were going to be for New Hampshire.
And again, talking about the jobs at stake, that's State Senator Jeb Bradley. So again, Mark, you were saying, look, if there's problems with jobs, do that differently. Don't hang it on the ratepayers. That seems to be your basic point there.
Yeah, exactly, Laura. You know, doing this through electricity rates is just, it's an end around because they don't want to, you know, approach it from a tax standpoint. And my good friend, Senator Bradley, said as much in testimony.
So, Jason, what about that? I mean, if the idea is to support the forest products industry, do it in another way, maybe a more open and transparent way than hanging it on the ratepayers.
You know, that's 365 is a three-year bill. And last year in the state budget, and this is one of the things that has us scratching our head about the governor's veto, last year in the state's budget, there was a study authorized through the Office of Strategic Initiatives to look at the biomass industry, its role in the state, and to look at ways to make sure its viability can be maintained long term. And the whole point of 365 was to say, all right, we've got a crisis here. Let's create a three-year bridge, allow the governor's office of strategic initiatives to do their work, and then let's look, are there other alternatives, are there other ways? But absent the 365, and we've already seen what's happened since the vetoes occurred, three of the plants have stopped buying fuel. And we've seen a contraction in logging out there in the forest. And, you know, what's the point of having a study if by the time they get to the study, the power plants have been shuttered and or scrapped?
There won't be anything.
The whole point of 365 was to try to create a three-year bridge to enable the Office of Strategic Initiatives to do their work. So that's the whole point of this, is we need a three-year bridge to do this, to enable this study to move forward and look at other alternatives.
All right. But gentlemen, we have to wrap it up there, but we'll be following
really
up on this real quickly. Yeah, super quick, Mark, if you could, that'd be great.
Sure. Sure. This idea that this is a temporary fix is, you can go back to news articles 7-8 years ago where they were asking for temporary assistance. This is not a temporary thing. This is going to go on forever. And that's, and by the way, 365, is not overridden and the veto is sustained. Not all these plants are going to close.
All right. The veto day is Thursday, so we'll see what happens then. Both of you, thank you so much for being with us. That's Mark Brown and Jason Stock. And coming up, we will start taking your questions and comments. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. You can help NHPR shorten the fall fund drive. Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. For every 100 listeners who become sustaining members, we'll knock off a full day of on-air fundraising this fall. It's that simple. So if you've been waiting for the perfect time to support the programs you love, like The Exchange, Fresh Air, and All Things Considered, this is it. Become an NHPR sustaining member today for as little as $5 or $10 a month. It's quick and easy to do at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the governor's veto of two alternative energy bills has sparked a huge campaign in recent weeks with signs, letters, rallies, and even a song.
Override the veto and free my soul. Diesel electric prices are out of control. I ain't going away.
Okay, so we had to play that. That's State Senator Kevin Avard of Nashua, known at the State House as the Singing Senator. He spoke and sang at a rally last week, urging fellow lawmakers to overturn the veto. And that's what we're looking at this hour. We're trying to unpack this. It's very complicated, as we're hearing. But it has ignited a huge debate here in New Hampshire about these vetoes and whether they should stand. Let's hear from you, of course. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The number is 1-800-892-6477. NHPR's Annie Ropeek is helping us out. She's our energy and environment reporter. And Annie, we just heard in our earlier segment from the Ratepayers Association, the Timberland Owners Association. It got kind of technical there, and I'm wondering if you can just help us unpack all that stuff about capacity markets and rate auctions
and
so forth.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that's so interesting about this whole fight is that this is a really wonky subject, and so to see it boiled down into this extremely politicized, rhetoric battle has just been fascinating for me as an
energy
reporter.
Bring your calculators to the battle, so to speak,
absolutely.
Right?
I was just doing a little bit back of the envelope math over here. So basically what Mark Brown from the Ratepayers Association was talking about there is that power generators make these commitments to the New England grid to provide power 3 years out. It's called the capacity auction. So they're basically saying, we will get paid to promise that we'll be around to provide power in 3 years. And this way we can guarantee that the lights stay on. And so the argument is that the biomass plants have already made some of those commitments and are already getting paid to promise to provide that power in the future. And so if they pulled out of the market, if they shut down, which some people say would result from this bill not passing, and we've actually already seen it happen this summer, some of them have gone into sort of standby mode while they wait to see what goes on, that would leave a big hole in ISO's 3-year promise, you know, rundown of power companies, and they would have to pay someone else to fill that hole. And that cost would also be passed on to ratepayers, sort of in a longer term way than the cost to ratepayers of these 3-year subsidies. Mark is right that that math hasn't been sort of quite as straightforwardly presented as the math about the cost to ratepayers over the 3 years if this bill does pass. But I think that Jason Stock's argument from the Timberland Owners Association is that biomass touches so many more things than just these 6 plants and the one waste energy plant, that, you know, these are people's jobs, these are local economies, as well as these capacity costs and potentially a domino effect, you know, of other plants and sort of the signals it would send to renewable energy. And that also gets at the net metering bill, which I think we're about to talk about. But,
you know, one of the things I didn't understand until I started prepping for the show, Annie, is, you know, everybody probably gets that if these biomass plants shut down, you know, loggers and landowners will lose a source of income. But one argument that's come up is that it will change land use. Snowmobilers are concerned. And when I heard that, I thought, well, why would snowmobilers be concerned about biomass?
Yeah, so this is a sort of a veiled threat, I want to call it, that we've been seeing come out from a lot of the timberland owners. They don't want to call it a threat, but they're saying, you know, if this bill doesn't pass, we do have 2 tools left in our toolkit. That's what Tom Thompson, the son of former Governor Meldrum Thompson, has been saying about his tree farm. And then he'll hold up a for sale sign and a no trespassing sign. And what those mean is that he is able to close his land to recreation if he wants to. Basically, any private land that you use for recreation is kind of an at-will thing. And a lot of our recreation in the state happens on private lands.
Most of it.
Yeah.
I mean, snowmobiling, it's hunting.
80-some percent of land in the state is privately owned. And so if you think about all the little networks of trails that cross through private lands, and you'll see the signs.
Hiking,
and
yeah,
I mean, you know, parts of the Mount Major trails and of the New Hampshire Audubon trails and all of those kinds of things are sort of at the whim of the landowners. And their argument is that we're letting you use these out of the graciousness of our hearts. And if you don't do this for us, we could potentially not just do it as, you know, revenge, but be forced to either start charging for land use or to tear down all our trees and develop that land in order to keep paying our bills.
So because biomass right now is helping us make a little bit of money.
Right.
That's
if we
argument.
Can still farm the trees on the land and sell them to biomass plants, then we're able to keep the land as is, let you keep using it for snowmobiling. And if we're not able to use it for biomass, we're going to have to make other plans. And those could involve you not being able to access the land or having to pay to do so.
All right. Well, let's go to our callers. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's take the first call. This is Representative Harrington calling in, I believe. Go ahead, Representative Harrington. You're on the air. Okay, seem to be having a little bit of trouble with the phones, so hope that person tries back. Let me remind you the number, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email, Mike from Bradford, who says, as a landowner in Bradford with a 1,200-acre tree farm, I'm currently having a timber harvest on my land. It's barely profitable, but I'm employing a forester, a couple of loggers, truckers, and the mills that are processing my wood products. Currently, my land is open for hunting and all kinds of non-motorized recreation. I don't believe in posting my land. If I can't profitably manage my land to pay the taxes and other fees, my only other option is to start selling off pieces of that land. Once land is developed, it's no longer open for all the traditional recreational opportunities that the people of our state want and expect. What will the landowner do when we lose these markets? And thank you, Mike, so much. And he's basically offering his own personal story to back up what you just said, Andy, the threats that landowners have been making, the worries they have if this biomass market goes away.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of the reason we do have so much private forested land in this state is because we have policies that encourage it to stay forested. You know, we let people use private land for recreation. We have current use laws that de-incentivize developing forested land and turning it into housing. And we you know, we value our green spaces. We don't want to cut down all those trees and not replant them and turn them into housing. And so that's one of the arguments that biomass supporters make, is that, you know, the reason it's a renewable fuel is because you can replant the trees and they'll keep sequestering carbon. You know, it sort of depends on how that actually plays out and what other sort of fuels it's replacing, whether that's actually a net benefit to the environment. But it certainly has the potential to be, and it's certainly a better benefit to the environment than, you know, flat housing land would be. And so that's the argument there.
Well, and a little bit later, Annie, we will bring in two environmentalists to talk about some of the arguments pro and con around biomass.
Interesting. They call them both environmentalists, which is true. And that's one thing I love about this story.
So, but let's go back to our listeners. And Tim is in Northampton. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks morning. For taking my call.
Sure.
I liked that earlier in the conversation about the energy subsidies. Annie reminded us that subsidies in the energy industry are nothing new. So what I think we can take away from this whole affair, this whole issue, is that subsidies depend upon influence. And even though the legislature, Republican legislature, voted to renew these subsidies, apparently the loggers, the upcountry people, renewable energy people, even the people with solar panels on their roof, took a second backseat to influence that came to bear upon our governor. So I might remind everybody that we have a governor who is quick to point out that he is a graduate of MIT with a degree in environmental engineering, and in the same breath informs us that he's not real sure that global warming is caused by humans.
Okay. Well, Tim, and he seems to be backing up the point that you made earlier, Annie, which is all forms of energy are subsidized. We just forget that other older forms were subsidized because it happened a long time ago. I mean, that seems to be the basic point there.
Yeah, and Tim also, you know, reminds me that the governor vetoed this bill as part of his tenure energy strategy, which says that all forms of energy should compete on a level playing field. And what Tim is reminding us is that there isn't really such a thing as a level playing field in our modern energy grid. It's really hard to actually achieve that complete free market competition. And so renewable energies and these alternative forms of energy, if we want them out there in the, you know, on the grid and providing some electrons to our homes, you know, they do need a bit of a leg up. And it's a leg up that older forms of energy have already received in order to guarantee that we're already always going to have electricity. And so, you know, Tim is criticizing the governor maybe for not supporting renewables as much as a super progressive climate change advocate would, and just saying, you know, let it all shake out on its own. And if they're worthwhile, they'll do fine. And if they're not, then they shouldn't be competing at all.
Well, and if you looked at the governor's energy plan, which was released in the spring, Annie, it's no surprise that he would veto these bills. You know, the energy plan is all about reducing rates. That's the number one focus of the governor's strategy. So he's been pretty clear about that.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the plan talks a lot about eliminating subsidies, letting different forms of energy compete on a level playing field, all with the goal, like you say, of reducing rates. But at the same time, you know, it makes some pretty direct references to things like Seabrook Nuclear Power Station. And obviously, Seabrook provides a huge chunk of our energy and is going to need some help from the government to stay afloat because it's going through its relicensing right now. And Sununu is a clear supporter of Seabrook. And so it'll be interesting to see how his opposition to subsidies and to sort of these incentives and government putting its thumb on the scale of different types of energy actually plays out when it comes to non-renewables, the less small-scale stuff. I mean, he was a big supporter of Northern Pass, too, right? So it's not as simple as just saying we have to lower rates. You have to actually figure out how to do it, and we're seeing that play out in all these different arguments.
Well, and I'm glad you said small-scale, because that segues us perfectly, Annie, to the other part of this veto uproar that we need to talk about. There's another bill that was paired with this biomass veto fight, if I could call it that. Mm-hmm. A second alternative energy bill concerning something called net metering. Now, you mentioned the wonkiness of it. Net metering is maybe the wonk of all wonkies. But what is this all about? Because a lot of folks at that rally last week were upset about net metering.
Yeah, these bills have really been lumped straight together. I mean, starting from the governor's own veto message, he did one veto message for these two bills that he vetoed at the same time. So we've been hearing about Senate Bill 365. This is Senate Bill 446, and it's about net metering, which is where if you have solar panels on your roof of your house or your factory, or if you're a town like Nashua that owns a hydro dam, you can basically sell that energy back to the grid and earn back the wholesale rates as sort of a credit on your bill. And so it's a way to produce your own power. You're putting some renewable energy into the grid that you're sharing with everyone else, and you're
get a little benefit,
earning a little money off of it. You know, maybe not profiting necessarily, although one of the arguments against net metering is that you, if you did enough of it, you could potentially profit from it. And that's one reason Sununu vetoed this, is because he sees this as a way for towns and factories to just sort of like make a little extra money off of the grid. But the fact is of net metering that it doesn't cost ratepayers anything up front. I mean, there's no pass on to ratepayers through a town doing more net metering. All it does is add some competition for companies like Eversource from customer generators. And that's something that a big utility like Eversource has some reason to oppose, because, you know, they benefit from being dominant in the space. And the more little extra competition there is in there from things like net metering or small biomass plants, the worse off they are.
Well, let's look at the environmental arguments around these this veto and these two bills. And with us now, Annie, are two more people who've been really focused on this end of the veto debate. With us now on the phone are Madeline Minot. She is Executive Director of the New Hampshire Sustainable Energy Association. Madeline, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure, Laura.
And also with us, Mike Ewald, founder and director of the Energy Justice Network, a national organization. And Mike, thank you for taking the time out. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, I'm going to turn to you first and just to talk a little bit about biomass, because that's what we talked about first. And then we will get into the net metering, because I know, Madeline, that's your big interest. But Mike, you said, look, biomass is not clean. The state should absolutely not be helping this industry out. But you're a national group here in New Hampshire. People say, look, it's renewable, it's locally sourced, way better than coal or natural gas. So how does that sort of local argument fall on your ears, Mike?
Okay, well, first of all, Senate Bill 365 is not just about biomass incineration. It's also about subsidizing the state's only trash incinerator in Concord. And that part has been largely ignored in this whole discussion. Trash incineration is the most expensive and polluting way to manage waste or to make energy. And we find this all across the country. And so there's a serious public health concern with the amount of pollution being put out by that small incinerator left in Concord. But these other six biomass incinerators are not far behind. They're one of the most expensive ways to make energy, and this is expressed by our National Energy Information Administration, as well as the obviousness of having to spend $68 million of subsidies in the next few years to subsidize these seven plants. But they're also one of the largest polluters in the state. These seven plants collectively are among the 13 largest air polluters of industry in the entire state. And those biomass burners, the four counties that they're in each of those counties, they're the largest air polluter that the county has. And they collectively make up the majority of industrial air pollution in each county, between 50-some and as much as 95% of the industrial air pollution. So that's a lot of a public health impact to be spending subsidies on when they ought to be going to clean energy sources instead.
Well, and Madeline, I did want to ask you about that because, as you know, the environmental community is split over biomass. Sure, it's local and sure, it's sustainable because you can plant another tree. But what about the air quality arguments that we're hearing from Mike?
So the six biomass plants in question have to abide by both federal and state air emissions permits and standards, and also in order to participate in the renewable portfolio standards of the state, they actually have to abide by air emission standards that are even stricter than their federal and state permits. And obviously they need the revenue from the participation in the RPS, so they are abiding by these even stricter air emission standards. And our own state environmental agency, their climate action plan, actually supports using forest source biomass for the production of electricity.
What about the trash incineration, Madeline? How concerned are you that that's also included in this bill?
So our organization does not advocate for waste to energy as a renewable resource. However, we feel that biomass is extremely important and that supporting these six biomass facilities and the 100 megawatts of locally sourced renewable energy that they produce is important enough that for us, having the waste incinerator included is beside the point. The importance of the biomass part of the bill is why we support it.
Well, and Madeline, another question for you about the net metering side of this, which Annie Ropeek just explained. That was also vetoed, and another veto that you'd like to see overturned. But the governor and others have said expanding net metering just forces utilities to buy electricity from small suppliers at above wholesale rates. And again, this raises the price for everyone. The governor's really been making the point that, you know, while individual industries may want a helping hand, we're talking about 1.3 million people here. So how do you see it, Madeline? Is net metering effectively just another subsidy?
No, the governor really got it wrong on this bill. Net metering and SB 446 does not create a subsidy. It does not create cost shifting. We had very long detailed proceedings at the PUC to set the compensation rate so that the commissioners confirmed they would not cause any unjust cost shifting. And that's the rate that the larger facilities that would be allowed to net meter under SB 446 would use. And pretty much what it does is to promote investment in right-sized renewable energy projects for larger electricity customers like businesses and manufacturers, just like smaller energy users like residential folks that have solar panels on their roof are able to do now.
Mike, you're in favor of net metering. How do you interpret that? That, again, this is kind of unfair, subsidizing some over others.
Right. Well, subsidies have historically gone to a lot of the largest air polluters and other types of polluters that we have. It's gone to the coal, oil, and gas industry, to the nuclear industry, and also to trash and biomass incinerators because they can't compete without a lot of these subsidies. But the point is, when you're dealing with such large polluters and we're in a day and age where we're trying to move away from them and transition to clean energy, is that we ought to be prioritizing any further subsidies for things that aren't contributing to cancer, to learning disabilities, to asthma attacks, to all the things that these biomass and trash burners in the state are strongly contributing to.
Wait, you're saying biomass here in New Hampshire is contributing to cancer and a host of other pretty serious maladies, Mike?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the pollutants that they're kicking out, they're putting out large amounts of nitrogen oxides that trigger asthma attacks. They're putting out large amounts of lead and mercury and chromium and arsenic, toxic metals that damage the brain, affect learning abilities, do all sorts of things to people's health. And these are actually some of the largest polluters in the state for these chemicals.
Well, we heard Madeline say a moment ago that these plants do have to operate under pretty strict state and federal rules. So that's not enough to keep the bad stuff from being pumped out, Mike?
No, that's laughable. First of all, the trash incinerator is not considered renewable energy in New Hampshire. So whatever strict standards she thinks she means on that don't even apply here because trash is not renewable in New Hampshire. The biomass burners that are considered renewable energy, even though that's quite debatable, are still among the largest air polluters in the state and are the largest air polluters in each of their counties, according to the latest EPA data that's reported by these facilities. So I'm not sure what standards he thinks exist on this, but they're far too weak for them to be prevented from being some of the biggest health-damaging air polluters New Hampshire has.
Okay, so lots of people want to jump into this conversation. Madeline, I'll give you a last quick word there, and then we'll wrap it up. Thank you. Go ahead, Madeline.
I think that supporting our own forest products industry in a very renewable, sustainable form of energy, I have to strongly disagree with the other caller that these create, you know, all sorts of horrible maladies. I think this is a very important source of energy here in New Hampshire. It's our own local forest products, supported by very trusted local organizations like the Society for Protection of New Hampshire Forests and New Hampshire Audubon.
All right, we will wrap it up there. Madeline Minot, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Mike Ewall, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Mike Ewall, founder and director of Energy Justice Network. Madeline Minot, executive director of the New Hampshire Sustainable Energy Association. Coming up, Annie Ropeek and I will take a lot more of your calls, emails, questions. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show for Primary Election Day, we'll stay non-political and ask what is up with all the squirrels in New Hampshire this year. Email us before the show and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. And then on Tuesday night, it's our primary election coverage beginning at 8 o'clock. So be sure to join us for that. A couple big state primaries this year, and we'll be keeping an eye on them. This hour, we're looking at whether the legislature will override a veto of two alternative energy bills, one concerning biomass, the other on what's called net metering. We've been hearing from a lot of voices involved on this debate from the environmental standpoint, from the economic standpoint. And let's hear from you, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR's Annie Ropeek, our environment and energy reporter, is with me in the studio for the full hour. And Annie, before we go back to our listeners, this whole idea of biomass, not to put it too simply, but good or bad for the environment. I mean, you're looking at that, right? Because it's tricky, as we just heard from those last two guests.
Yeah, it is super tricky. I mean, it's something that even EPA scientists haven't been able to agree on over the years, although under Scott Pruitt, the EPA did just declare biomass to be carbon neutral, but it's basically a scientific open question, and it really depends on how you're burning the biomass, what other fuels it's replacing, how you're replanting the trees, you know, what the other state of the environment is in the area. So, you know, when you have that many open questions, you know, people like Mike Ewald, who we heard from last segment, say that we shouldn't be having to ask those many questions. If, you know, if you have to ask, then it's probably a net environmental detriment. But others like Madeline Mino say that that this encourages healthy forestry. That's an argument we hear a lot from the timber side of things, that they have to cut down these low-grade trees in order to be able to harvest the good trees and to make the forest grow well and to create open space for animals. Of course, we made the forests like this by planting the low-grade trees back in the day for the paper mills, but we're stuck with them now, and so the argument is that, you know, in order to be able to manage them, we need a home for them, and that home is biomass. And don't forget that if we didn't have these plants, they probably wouldn't be replaced with wind and solar. At least in the short term, they'd be replaced with natural gas on the grid.
All right. Well, let's go back to our listeners, Annie. And Mike from Stratford is on the line. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. I have to say I disagree with your expert, so-called expert there. I'm a state representative, Mike Harrington. I'm also a former public utilities commissioner, and I also was on the workforce that developed the forward capacity market, which Ann speaks of incorrectly. Simply, it doesn't work the way she says. If these plants close and if they still have a capacity supply obligation, then they're obligated to sell that to somebody else and make up the difference. So if they're in, let's just say they took one out in FCA 12, I don't know if they did, the closing price was $4.63 a megawatt month, a kilowatt month, they would simply have to sell that to somebody else or come up with the money. It wouldn't cost the ratepayers of New Hampshire a single dime. This whole idea that these plants leaving the market is going to drive up prices is just wrong. If you go back and look, FCA 10 closed at a little over $7. FCA 11 was $5.20.
Okay, what's FCA 10 and FCA 11?
Okay, that's forward capacity auction. That's how the capacity prices are set. So the forward capacity auction, the most recent one closed at $4.63, substantially lower than the one from a couple of years ago. And a few reasons for that. One, they started with over 4,000 megawatts of excess capacity. In other words, the original bids that came in, we had 4,000 megawatts more than they wanted to buy. And so the price keeps going down until those people
So, Mike,
out.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is really confusing for the average person. I'm really glad you called because you've got experience here. First of all, just to defend Annie a little bit, she's telling us the arguments that she's been hearing as a reporter. She's not saying X, Y, Z, this is
all right. Well, then
how
I
it works. So,
otherwise.
But I did want to ask you one other question. So is the bottom line for you, Mike, that we should not have, that these vetoes should be overridden or that they should be sustained? Because it's still unclear to, I think, a lot of people when you get into this level of detail where you stand.
Right. Okay, sure. They should be sustained because it'll cost the ratepayers over $20 million a year. And you have to remember, these biomass plants have been subsidized by over $2 billion. That's billion with a B. back when the back under PURPA, which was a federal law that required the utilities to pay them what the federal government projected was future energy costs. Well, as most things, when the federal government projects in the future, they were wrong, and they overpay them for $2 billion. Look at your electric bill. You'll see a thing called stranded cost.
Right.
Most people think that's Seabrook. Well, $1 billion with Seabrook, $2 billion with these small biomass and hydro plants.
So you're saying they've already had their subsidies, and it's enough already, basically.
Enough.
When to put it in layperson's terms.
Yeah, and the other thing you mentioned is that it would be like me walking into the welfare office and saying, I want food stamps. And they said, well, okay, show us your income. I'm not going to show you anything. I tell you I need food stamps. Give them to me.
Well, Mike, hang on one sec. It's great to hear from you. Annie wants to ask you a quick question, too, please. So go ahead.
So my representative, on the capacity issue, is there a cost associated with ISO then having to seek a new capacity commitment from a different utility or a different generator after the biomass plants have sold their obligations? I mean, how do those costs get passed on to ratepayers, just in a word?
Sure. The way the market works is there's much more supply than there is demand, and people drop out. As I said, in FCA 10, the price was $7. In FCA 12, it was $4. And during that time, thousands of megawatts of generators dropped out. Most of your coal plants, Vermont Yankee, dropped out, 640 megawatts. And the price went down, and it went down substantially because people, that's how markets work. They think they can make enough money, more people come in. And like I said, we started FCA 12, which was the last auction, with 4,000 megawatts of surplus. To put that in perspective, the amount they wanted to buy was 34,000. So it was more than 10% surplus. So 100 megawatts in a market where you're buying 34,000, over 34,000, is not going to make any difference whatsoever.
I see what you're saying. So saying we're going to lose 100 megawatts, you're saying it's not that much of the whole pie. Mike, really good to hear from you. Going to go to some other callers now, but I really appreciate you calling in. Thank you. And let's go next to Bill in Lee. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
This is Bill Fortune, Industrial Consultants. I'm running for state rep in Stratford County, and spent 4 years studying the cost of electricity.
Wow. Okay.
And what we've learned is that New Hampshire produces 70% of its power for approximately 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And the free market cost to distribute that power to the customer would be 2.5 cents. So we shouldn't be paying more than 5 or 6 cents for power at your meter. Now, that brings us to the other issue, is that if we want to produce all our own power, and I think we should, then the taxpayer has already funded development of what we call Generation 4 power plants that are greenhouse gas free, walk away safe, and economical. And we could generate 110% of our power. 10% is for contingency. And I claim that we should then sell that power to people in New Hampshire first.
So I'm sorry, Bill, I'm a little unclear on where you feel about this help for the biomass industry and the net metering.
I'm coming to that.
Okay. Please come so a little more quickly, because we got to close out the hour.
The biomass costs about 10 cents per kilowatt hour, and we're already paying the 300% tax on electricity as it is. So these people up north are going to have to go out of business because we just can't afford that kind of money, for one. And we got to look at how many jobs are impacted by all these social programs that are placed on the cost of electricity.
Wow. Okay. Bill, thank you very much for the call. Annie, lots to unpack there.
Yeah. So a couple things that Bill's call brings to mind for me are that, I mean, it sounds like Bill, you know, potentially could be a fan of net metering. I mean, we're talking about wanting to have more homegrown energy independence here, not having to import so much power. And the biomass plants, you know, do fit that bill, as do customer generators doing net metering, because that's all homegrown. But on the other hand, you know, the biomass plants do sort of go above regular market costs. And especially with these subsidies, you know, we would be paying more for them than we would for the average electron, at least in the short term. And so I think what Bill is saying is that that's not worth it. But at the same time, you know, he mentions the jobs that would be affected. One of the arguments that supporters make is that it's not just the 900-some people that work in the biomass plants who are affected. It's the loggers, it's the truck drivers, it's local businesses. We hear a lot of mentions of, like, the loggers aren't stopping in for lunch on Main Street anymore, you know, those kinds of things. And it isn't just a North Country issue. A lot of logging happens in Merrimack and Hillsborough counties, things like that. And so, you know, there are secondary and tertiary impacts to think about here. But at the same time, you know, Bill says that they're going to have to go out of business. And I think that's really interesting because one of the criticisms of Sununu's veto has been that he didn't have a plan to save those jobs. And it's not, again, just about the biomass industry. I mean, the timber industry is at a bit of a crossroads here. With the death of the paper mills and potentially the death of biomass, I mean, they're looking for more things to do with wood that just doesn't have a home anymore. And there's research and development on new markets for that, new materials we could be making with it, but it's far out. And is, you know, not guaranteed to materialize. And so I think their argument is that we need a bridge to at least get there so that we can figure out what to do. But it's really reminiscent to me of coal, of what happened to the coal industry, that, you know, this is just a manufacturing process that society may be moving away from. And that affects people's livelihoods. And government may or may not have a role in trying to help those people transition out of that dying industry. And we're seeing that play out here. And so if the bill doesn't end up passing, I think the next question from the timber sector will be, okay,
now what?
Exactly, exactly.
Now what do we do? Exactly. Yeah, well, Anna, we could have talked for three more hours, judging from the response from our listeners. But one last quick question. What do you make of the fact that a lot of Republicans who generally really like the governor, think he's spot on with most of his policies, you know, Tom Thompson, Kevin Avar, Jeb Bradley, in this instance, they're saying, no, governor, you're wrong.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I mean, this is really, it was, the bill's passed with bipartisan support initially, and we've seen bipartisan support for overturning the vetoes. You know, this is a manufacturing issue on both sides. And so the loggers are able to really drum up support on both sides. You know, they come from red districts. And Jeb Bradley is the prime example. I mean, those are his constituents, and he's been, you know, strong out on this issue for a long time. And so we are seeing more Republicans come to join the fray on this issue, and it'll be really interesting. It's a bit of a toss-up in the House, especially still, as to whether these vetoes are going to be sustained or not.
Okay, and veto day is Thursday.
That's right.
Veto override day, excuse me, is Thursday.
We will see what happens.
Okay, you'll be busy. Thanks, Annie, for helping us out. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NH.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.